Hello, I'm Marshall Gantz. Welcome to Faces of Change, a podcast series from the Leading Change Network, in which we talk to people who practice leadership by organizing people to work together to build the power they need to win the change their communities want. Today, I'm joined by Diana Jay, the co-founder and director of organizing for the Sunrise Movement, the dynamic movement of young people and allies who are moving forward demands for climate justice in the United States. Over the last 2 years, they've catapulted the Green New Deal into national consciousness and are organizing thousands of young people in chapters across the country for climate action. I really enjoyed my conversation with Diana. We explored the story of how young people built Sunrise as a major force from the ground up. We talked about Diana's own journey to movement organizing for climate change and the importance, the power of sustained learning for building a powerful movement. And we explored how we can seize this very moment to create the change our communities want and need. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to like and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite streaming service. Thanks for joining us today, Diana.
Hi, Marshall. Nice to see you.
Perhaps you could say a little bit about the work you do at Sunrise and what Sunrise is up to at the moment.
The core mission of Sunrise is to build an army of young people to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process. And we launched in 2017, united in a vision that there were millions of young people who wanted to work with us and work together to kind of rise up to three main challenges is what we set out as our mission. One was to end the corrupting influence of fossil fuel executives on our politics. The second is to make climate change matter as an urgent priority across the country. And the third was to elect a new generation of leaders who could fight for us. And throughout that mission in 2018, as you said, what we're most known for is launching the vision of the Green New Deal into kind of the political conversation in the country. And the Green New Deal as kind of the most ambitious and transformative national project that our country has taken on since FDR's New Deal and since the World War II scale economic mobilizations. And seeing the Green New Deal fundamentally as a 10-year plan, 10-year agenda to mobilize every aspect of American society to move to 100% clean and renewable energy by 2030, to guarantee a living wage job to everyone who needs one, building that new economy, and to ensure a just transition to workers in frontline communities. So that's still our core mission and what we're working towards. I mean, we're talking at a unique time. So what is the work right now? Totally in disruption. We're really wrestling with core question of what does it mean to build a social movement under social isolation and how do we do that and still chase towards our mission this year to win governing power with enough power that we can hold government accountable to the vision and the mission of the Green New Deal.
How is it that all of a sudden we all heard about Sunrise?
There's a couple ways to answer that question. I think there's the flashpoint answer and then the long-term planning answer. So I'll start with the flashpoint answer.
Cool.
How most people came to know about Sunrise was about a week after the election in November 2018. I was one of 50 young people who was arrested in Nancy Pelosi's office, holding signs saying 12 years and what's your plan? And we had come together, kind of a lot of our mission in 2018 really was to unite the movement to deliver a youth intervention in the 2018 midterm elections to make the climate crisis matter. And we had been working day in and day out to elect candidates who would fight for us leading up to the election. And I remember in like October, I think it was 2018, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had put out this report that a lot of us know that kind of gave us this new deadline of we have 12 years to dramatically transform our economy and our society to stave off the worst of the climate crisis. And it felt like this earth-shattering kind of new timeline and reality check. And that was in October right before the election. And still we're like working so hard to put new leaders into office and seeing that there's like no coherent plan coming together that actually rises to the timeline and urgency of the climate crisis. So we have this dual strategy of people power and political power. As soon as the election was over, we're kind of like, what's next and how do we push it forward? And knew that we needed to kind of come in strong with a vision. And 6 days after the election, united our movement. We had about 200 people ready to go into Nancy Pelosi's office to ask that question of what is your plan? And we're joined by then Representative-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to launch the vision of the Green New Deal. Yeah, and it was a totally whirlwind moment. I was playing an action coordinator role at the time. And I think about that moment. We were so loud and there was so much energy and so much spirit with all the young people and Nancy Pelosi's office. And then 50 of us ended up being arrested. And, you know, like we came out later that night and celebrated and appreciated each other and had no idea the extent of the impact that that had had. And then over the next 24 hours had seen a couple thousand articles written on the Green New Deal and saw this kind of spark that we had helped catalyze and had lit a flame. And then we had thousands of people knocking on our doors saying, how do I get involved in this fight? What can I do? And came into this massive growth moment for our movement.
It must have been like trying to drink from a fire hose that broke loose. You didn't expect that. Why do you think it happened?
For a lot of the leadership in that moment, it was both this, wow, this is unexpected. And, you know, here we are suddenly with a mass amount of momentum and people are knocking on our doors to join the movement. And this kind of balance with this sense of calm of we had been working towards this moment for a really long time. And I guess to kind of answer that, you know, I can get more into the story of how did Sunrise start and where did we come from and where did that planning come from? Really, Sunrise came from kind of a labor of love of a dozen people who got together in 2016, pretty deeply worried about the state of the country and about the climate crisis and the direction of our country, and started to really study and dig into past movements together. And that team was kind of a ragtag team from a lot of different places. We had some folks on our team had their first experience with social movements and the Occupy movement and saw it kind of balloon in growth and then also collapse and lose direction as a unified movement. We had a number of leaders come out of the fossil fuel divestment movement who had also seen massive growth and built a formidable generation of campaigners, won a lot, but ultimately kind of couldn't get off campus and couldn't get into the political system. I, at that time, I'd been organizing for a couple of years with students in Virginia, working towards a state-level vision of energy policy. And just, we were just getting kind of crushed every single year by the fossil fuel monopoly that really ran our state government and struggled to build like a united team of leaders that could withstand that over time. So we're this team of kind of a collection of experiences and movement work and also a collection of failures. And we're really united in 2016, both by like a deep desire to study and also a kind of understanding of the political moment. And the political moment at that time was, it's 2016, the climate movement was kind of more powerful than ever. We had come off of building this mass movement around the Keystone XL pipeline and the divestment movement. Yes. But we felt still this feeling of sitting on the sidelines once we hit the election year. Like there's no shared strategy to fight for governing power or to influence the governing agenda. And we felt like, you know, we were kind of watching the rise of Bernie Sanders and that shared a lot of the same rhetoric of the climate movement, but there was no shared strategy to fight. And it felt, it felt really stagnant in the election year. And we knew we needed a movement that could do both protest and politics. And we united by study. And what I mean by that of just kind of, a deep desire to dig in and learn. And we had come together through the Momentum Training Institute, which I know you're familiar with, and started to learn about the core theory that there about all movements have a DNA, a story, a strategy, and a structure, and a culture. A lot of times that's not intentionally designed, but you can intentionally design a DNA that can guide a movement. And that was the question that started to kind of unite us together is how do we build a movement that gives members the autonomy that can really charge and lead to rapid growth while maintaining unity and strategy and purpose. So in 2016, we decided to take that leap, and about a year of work happened in designing the DNA of Sunrise, the story and the strategy and the structure, that led us to that moment and launched in spring of 2017 with the initial movement DNA of Sunrise was a 12-page Google doc and a set of PowerPoint slides. Called the Sunrise Movement Plan. And, you know, it's since been updated and adapted to meet our needs, but started from that point.
With Trump unexpectedly elected, I'm curious, how did you adapt to that?
Well, we took much more seriously the question of building and winning political power. We studied, I think about, you know, the sort of things we studied at that time too, of studying the organizing in the early 60s and studying SNCC. We were really inspired by Freedom Summer, and we got a lot more grounded in that we need to play a role, and everyone needs to play a role in very seriously fighting for political power and putting in place champions who can fight for our vision and not just sit out on a lot of social movements. I think play the push and push and push role and then don't have the strategy to kind of build towards actually winning power. And that was the challenge that we took a lot more seriously after Trump was elected and built that into the DNA of Sunrise.
That's interesting because I can relate to the Freedom Summer stuff because that was my introduction to organizing in 1964, working in Mississippi. It was really where I found my calling. In those moments, experiencing the crucial role that young people played in the movement. Mm-hmm. So you launch, and in 2018, it starts to explode?
Well, in 2017, the first kind of started the work of the movement was running the No Fossil Fuel Money campaign. And that was the first thing we did was start to push candidates at every level of office to take the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge and to reject campaign contributions from fossil fuel CEOs and front groups and lobbyists. And that's where we start to experiment, I'd say, for the first time with like a political confrontation, moral protest strategy. We had young people find moments where we could confront both kind of the worst of the worst politicians who take all of the fossil fuel money and just ask questions kind of like, how can you sleep at night? And then show up to people who had, you know, bad policies on climate change and put young people into the room and say, does this have to do with the X $100,000 you took from, you know, X fossil fuel company? And we started to see that there was a lot of power in that, that there was kind of this explosive potential of confronting the political elite and with young people with a moral vision. And that's, you know, we started to learn that in that campaign and also just started to kind of get some feet under us of how to campaign, how to build a shared campaign across a very vast country and in different places. And then in 2018, we were still running that campaign and then started to, you know, this is where we studied a lot more from Freedom Summer. We ran a program called Sunrise Semester. We kind of funneled in the movement into key places and we door knocked day in, day out. We did the hard work and we had about 70 young people mostly volunteering full time, and then other people in different parts of the country giving X amount of time that they could, a few hours here and there, to call in and support. But that was kind of the same, you know, the same hard work that we're doing constantly. And we got behind some people who were really inspiring. We had some really tough losses as well. And we were in Pennsylvania, we were in Michigan, we were in New York, we were in Minnesota. And, you know, some of the losses where we had were hard, but that's part of the work. And we had some big wins like Rashida Tlaib and getting behind Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And that was a big place where we also saw the power of kind of putting new champions in. But we hadn't lost the like, oh, we had really learned something about the power of confrontation and knew that it would take like a next level of confrontation to put our vision on the table and felt, you know, like really that experience in 2018 was, we felt proud of those victories and it was a hard time. It was like, we thought it would feel happy at the election in 2018. We thought maybe there'd be a lot to celebrate, but the tone really ended up being that election really unearthed a glaring, the like very, glaring voter suppression that took place in 2018 and has continued to take place. And there's not a lot to be like that inspired by, even though we had these points of victory. And so we.
Yeah. It was strange. It had a different rhythm to it, sort of a slower unfolding kind of rhythm.
No. Yeah. I mean, it was one of those, we didn't know quite how to feel kind of moments, but leading up to that moment where we kind of had this clarity of, we knew that in any outcome of the election, whether the Democrats took the House or whether the Republicans maintained control, there was going to be a moment for us to expose the entrenched elite of the political class and the lack of a plan around the climate crisis, either out of straight denial or just not having a plan enough on either side. I mean, of course, the GOP and the Democrats aren't nearly the same in this situation. GOP is much worse of a villain, but there was not much to be inspired of like a vision that we could fight for. And so that was really the energy in which like we kind of went into Nancy Pelosi's office and launched the vision of the Green New Deal and kind of had the bigger moment of confrontation of what is your plan and where do we go from here?
That's so interesting. It's like something that was late and then burst to the surface, sparked by your action. It's an amazing thing when it happens, the feeling. I remember Jeremy Ornstein doing an amazing job with his story outside Nancy Pelosi's office.
Yeah. I mean, that's a moment I remember in the middle of that action. It was crazy and there's all these cameras and I was kind of on my phone trying to coordinate. And then there was the police were showing up and Jeremy Ornstein kind of comes out of Nancy Pelosi's office into the middle of the hallway, screaming his personal story. And so rooted in the sense of hope and just believing that, you know, I remember him saying kind of like, I have hope that Nancy Pelosi will walk out of this room right now and join us and say, yes, we can win a Green New Deal. And it was so, I remember being caught in the chaos and then having this moment where I just looked up and people were crying all around me. And it was this grounding emotional moment amidst the chaos of running a direct action in the middle of the halls of Congress. And that's like a lot of the spirit, I think, of Sunrise is the chaos and still showing up with like the fullness of our emotions and singing songs and telling our stories.
Singing songs is interesting. I don't know of many real movements that don't have a song. The language of emotion is so important in movements and for sustaining people. And finding the courage for solidarity and singing is one of the key ways of doing that.
When you were part of Freedom Summer, was song a big pillar of that?
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, because of course, you know, culturally, I mean, it came out of the Black church. The Freedom Songs were all adaptations, basically, of church songs, most of them. And so it was very much a singing movement and like in a mass meeting. But when people would be put in jail and in different cells, then somebody would start to sing. And so then it was sort of this feeling of connectedness, everybody singing together, even though in different cells or maybe across different racial boundaries. So song played a really critical role for solidarity and hope. And courage. And it was really important in that movement.
Mm-hmm. Song is very big in Sunrise. And I mean, we felt we had to really reclaim it. I think the team of us who came together built Sunrise. We'd kind of, a lot of us, I mean, we've been organizing for maybe, we're all young, but we've been organizing for kind of a range of 3 to 5 years across our plates. And a lot of us were kind of like, feels like it could just be a lot better and we could feel a lot more connected and we could have a lot more spirit. And we think singing is a core ingredient to get there. We know that movements used to sing and we're not really sure what happened. And so we really started that as a practice in ourselves and that team of 12 of us who went through the year kind of prepping to design Sunrise before we launched. We were like, you know, if we can't practice it ourselves, then our movement will never be a movement that sings. And so we sang all the time, every meeting, for all, and every time we needed to come back together or shift the mood, we would sing, and then it pretty naturally spread out across the movement.
I'd like to just go back to the beginning. What about you?
I grew up in coastal Virginia, Hampton Roads, Virginia.
What do your folks do?
Both of my parents are actually geologists, and my mom taught geology for most of my life in high school or community college, and my dad worked around geological, like satellite mapping. And I mean, so that is definitely part of the story. I mean, I grew up family road trips, pulling off to the side of the road. Mom would run out of the van and like have magnifying glass and a chisel and take a sample of rock and tell us where we were and how long ago it was formed. And
did you get into the rocks yourself?
Not as much. I mean, I guess I can't say no. I did study ecology and have a little bit of the gene, but you know, I caught the social movement organizing bug, and then it transformed my life. And now I'm doing this probably for the rest of my life. So I think the being a scientist is ship has sailed, although that was a big choice for a long time. And
did you go to public school or private school?
I went to public school growing up in public school through college. I went to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
What did you study there?
I studied environmental science, focused on ecology. I studied like soil, carbon, did research around that. And then I also had this major, I mean, this was a kind of funny, this is a lot more about how I got to movements. I kind of found this rebellious group of students who were mad at the university and felt like they weren't getting a critical take on globalization and kind of what's going on in our world. And so they started their own major with a professor they really liked called Global Development Studies. And it ended up being a place to really explore questions of social movements and how we create change. And I mean, I was raised by scientists, so I never like imagined I would come out of the science field. And that was just out of sight for me. And then I found this kind of band of students who really want to dig into these critical questions. And it was part of, how I kind of came to doing the work.
Why do you think that clicked with you? Had you been doing activist stuff in high school or middle school?
No, not as much. I mean, I guess the kind of moment that there was a couple of moments, that shifted me. I think, I grew up very kind of curious about climate change because of where I grew up. Yeah. Coastal Virginia is an amazing place. I really loved growing up there and loved the culture along the coast and the community crab bakes and that coastal community. And also I grew up just, it was kind of normal to be out of school for weeks because of flooding. And my city spent millions of dollars pumping. They had these huge tubes that would send out into the ocean to suck sand up from way out and out on the ocean shelf and pump it back onto the beaches to delay the washing away of our beaches. And then I saw, how that was how like tourist and wealthy neighborhoods were prioritized on preserving the coastline, and saw how Black and Brown neighborhoods were flooded and how lower income neighborhoods had to leave their homes, and just like started to understand how that impacted our community. And
did you see those equalities then?
It's funny to think back on for me, because it's like I saw it and it impacted me. I really did not understand that as climate change. And that's the thing, that it's like growing up along the coast, you're just kind of like everything's wet all the time and everything's always flooded. And I thought that was normal. And it wasn't really until I did go to school. I went to school close to the mountains in Virginia, and I mean, a particular moment that I'm thinking of is this man named Larry Gibson came and spoke at my university. I don't know if you know do you know Larry Gibson?
No.
Okay, he's kind of looks like the Lorax. They call him the Keeper of the Mountains, and he's got like a Lorax kind of vibe going on and energy. And he comes from West Virginia, and he came and spoke at my university and told us the stories of mountaintop removal coal mining, and was kind of like, hey, whoever wants to come to my house, come and I'll show you what's going on. And so of course a group of us were kind of like, okay, let's go. And we went and we drove to Cayford Mountain, and he had, his family had been offered millions of dollars to get up and leave so that the place that they have lived for generations could be turned over to mountaintop removal coal mining, which is this practice of blowing up mountaintops to reach thin seams of coal within them. And you could see from where you stand at his house, just like the destruction of the sea of mountains blown up around him. And it was so shocking to me. But more so, I saw how Larry kind of made this choice to stay and said, I will do everything I can to protect my home. And I wanted to do that too, really. I was starting to put the pieces together that, it's not, what was happening in my home is not just normal flooding. It's increasing. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. And I wanted to protect the place that I came from. But at the same time, I think by that point, I'm probably 21 this time. And it had felt pretty clear to me that I couldn't live in the place that I called home, like the idea of living where I came from because of the climate change was felt not possible. I couldn't imagine raising a family there. I couldn't imagine living there, and just started to feel this kind of inner rage of nobody should actually have to go through that. What Larry Gibson was going through or what I was going through, that no one should have to live in fear of losing the place they call home from a crisis that could be prevented, from neighborhoods that didn't have to flood, mountains that didn't have to be blown up, and everyone should have a right to a home and clean air and clean water. And that started to burn kind of this inner fire of wanting to do everything I could to protect the place that I called home, and turning me towards this generational fight for climate justice, and finding answers to that question in that fight, and started to feel at that age that would be the work that I would dedicate the rest of my life to.
The way you describe with such love the place you grew up and then seeing it destroyed, it must have been like an assault, not something abstract about rocks, but about home and what that means. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like that's how it felt for me, and especially in my early years of kind of coming to the work of organizing and social movements and climate change, it was all about home. It was about, you know, fighting for the place that I called home. I was fighting for my community. It was understanding how this had very present localized impacts and believing that we could do something about that and starting to understand how. And that's kind of everything that it was for me. And as I feel like I really resonate with a lot. I think this is kind of a core challenge for a lot of young people right now, is people move around a lot. There's a lot less participation in religious institutions. Yeah. And there's so much of this, where is home? Where do I belong? And I went through that a lot in my early 20s, especially just feeling not ready for the world, feeling not grounded, not knowing where to find answers, and really started to turn to social movements for me to find a grounding of community. And so when we were designing Sunrise, I think that's something I thought about a lot of my own journey and finding in this kind of collapse of institutions that have served as community anchors in our life, how can we build that in, you know, in the purpose of fighting for the vision of the world we believe in? How do we build a sense of community in the fight for the Green New Deal? How can we build and support people to find teams around them and build that sense of purpose so that, we can find that rootedness and that sense of purpose. And that's been a big part of how we do our work.
So then a little bit more about after college, then what happened then?
So I graduated in 2015, and I can kind of take you through what's the swirling path that led me to Sunrise, which was that kind of year and a half after school. I went very deep into scientific research, kind of a little bit on accident. It was like this, I went through a bit of a, you know, am I existential question of, am I going to organize for the rest of my life, or will I do science? And then I did a lot of research in a lab and got really, really lonely and was like, all right, I think I know what I want to do. But in 2015, the kind of big thing at that time was, Paris Climate Agreement. And I had been, at that point, I had been organizing for a few years mostly with students across Virginia and focusing on action at the state level and in our communities around energy and climate justice, and had the opportunity to lead a delegation of young people to the United Nations climate negotiations in Paris. And it felt like this big moment, a challenge that I want to rise to it. And so I said, yes, of course. And for a lot of 2015, that was just what I was driving towards the whole year. The negotiations were at the end of the year. Spent all the time building this all-star team, building campaigns with other young people across the world, really around fighting for the most ambitious goal in the agreement, fighting for rich countries to pay their fair share. And then I was in Europe for the few months leading up to those negotiations. They take place in this final 2 weeks of everyone from around the world comes together and is negotiating to put together this deal. And everyone, when I think about those moments, I just think of people running around, and it's a kind of a chaotic place. And I'm thinking of the moment at the very end of the negotiations. And like, I remember sitting in this plenary hall, there was like 1,000 people in there. It's probably 7 p.m. on a Sunday when the gavel finally fell and they had reached the end of the final Paris Climate Agreement. And, you know, it was 48 hours past when it was supposed to. People had been negotiating through the night and it's really chaotic. And it was kind of that moment of that you imagine like in the movies where things are flying off the press. They're printing the final agreement. Everyone's rushing and running around to get a copy. And people are crying, some people are celebrating. And I just remember having this moment, like in the middle of that chaos, feeling, I had this deep feeling of feeling so far away from home. And feeling, it was like the agreement, people were upset that the agreement wasn't ambitious enough. And I was upset about that. But what was even worse, and what felt really clear to me in that time, was the United States was so far away from even coming close to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. even if they were not enough, you know, like that gap was massive. And I knew that very clearly. I knew that because I'd been organizing for years and I knew that, you know, my state didn't have a plan and nobody had a plan. And that we hadn't built enough power to hold our governments accountable. And it was this kind of like moment of foolishness. I was kind of like, what am I doing in like an airport hangar in Paris at these global negotiations when I know where the work is and the work is at home and we haven't built the movement that we need to build to actually measure up to the change that we're fighting for here so far away from home. And so I came, it was actually a very devastating moment in my life. I came back home from Paris and went to my parents' basement, confused and out of college and pretty devastated by the kind of pain of it all and not knowing where to go. And in my work as an organizer, I mean, I'm sure you've had this moment as well for you. And I'm curious over the years, it was kind of one of those moments of, I thought I knew a lot and now I feel like a child again. And I know nothing.
Yes.
And
that's a sign of wisdom, by the way.
I'd hope so. It did definitely, it was a helpful reckoning for me because it was in that moment that I really committed. I didn't want to do anything other than study. I just kind of started to study very deeply, that's when I really started to study SNCC for the first time in a deep way. And that's when I came into momentum trainings and I was just spending all night on these online webinars and trying to get some sense of the answer to the question of how do we build the formidable youth movement that actually can shape the course of our country. And through studying is really how I came to connect with other young people that I was talking about before, the group that came together to build Sunrise, kind of out of the divest movement, out of Occupy, out of organizing it in our states. And it was one of those times where I didn't know where we were going. I didn't know where we were going, but it felt like we were asking the right questions. And now that takes us to the moment where we're in 2016 and kind of took the leap to say, you know, who are we to think we can start to design a movement, but also who are we not to rise to that challenge as we're thinking of these questions? And we said, sure, let's do it, and committed to that next year of building Sunrise.
I just heard such a deep commitment to learning. And if there's one thing to build a movement or really do much of anything, it's constant learning. So I'm curious how you found the initial Sunrise team. How did you do that?
I mean, at first it was three different sub teams and they were kind of heard about each other and we're like, oh, you're asking the same questions that we're asking. And here's what we're thinking about. Okay. And you know, here, let me send you our Google doc and okay, we'll send you our Google doc. And there's kind of three different teams early. And then we realized that we were asking the same questions and using the same resources to challenge ourselves. And then there was a moment where we were asked ourselves if we want to do this together. And the answer was yes. And so we made a pretty rigid commitment. I mean, the team was 12 people, very committed. We had, kind of a threshold of time that we committed to the team. We spent a long weekend, 3 or 4 days together every 1 to 2 months, all living in a house together and would, you know, pop around the country in different places that were closer to our travel spots. At one time it was at my house and in Central Virginia. And that, you know, that was the foundation that held us together.
Coming back to the present, Sunrise has had this explosion period. Then we have the virus. Many people said this is what urgency actually feels like, because this is a kind of urgency that climate change would require. A subdimension is the technology question and how we use technology. I haven't heard much about technology in the way that you've described your movement building up to now. Could you just share your thinking about this moment right now?
Well, yeah. Let me start with a piece on technology. That's an interesting question. And it's interesting to hear you say, I don't hear you talking about technology in your movement, which makes me feel good because I want the movement to feel offline and real and in person with people and very grounded in that way. And at the same time, I look at our budget for the programs and movement, I'm like, wow, we spent a lot of money on tech tools. And there's kind of all this world of experimenting with different technology tools to grow the movement. And I think maybe I'll go and say just a little recap of how we kind of understand the core pillars of our organizing model and technology in that. And then I want to pivot and come back to the present moment because it's juicy and I'm curious what you're thinking as well. So I talked to you about how we built a DNA, and the success of Sunrise has really been in the success of being able to give that DNA away to 10 to hundreds of thousands of people who are then able to operate both with the deep autonomy that they can grow the movement locally and build the strategy out, as well as the unity that holds the movement together. And then to take that further, the kind of to take the movement out of DNA into, you know, what are we actually doing? We really see our movement building model rooted in four key components. And I'll get to the technology piece in here at the fourth component. But the first is, we've talked a bit about training. Mm-hmm. The first element I'd say is mass training program. It's the first thing we built as a movement was a mass training program, which really has the function of protecting the integrity of the movement by training people to implement and defend the movement DNA, and also train people to move along different leadership levels through in-person and online sessions. The second pillar we've also talked about a lot, which is moral protest. And moral protest really functions in Sunrise as it powers sparked rapid growth through drawing the attention of the media and politicians and forcing polarization, people picking a side of starting the movement or you know, with fossil fuel lead is who we're polarizing against, and draws in the membership base of young people that we're organizing. The third component is what I would say is what I understand to be your craft as well, is the deep tradition of local community organizing. And so we did our best to understand and root that in Sunrise as a core pillar as well of Sunrise members taking on the day-to-day work of issue organizing and electoral organizing, community building, and doing the pretty steady and often slower, deliberate growth of one-to-one recruitment, one-to-one relationship building, team building, leadership development, and that's really held in our core movement structure, which we call hubs, kind of the local unit of Sunrise that holds a lot of the power and structure of the movement. The fourth kind of core pillar of how we build a movement is through distributed organizing, which is where we do use a lot, where we are very much online, and we try to catch people who encounter the movement online and have a light brush with it and guide them through, okay, do this action now and now take a step further. And now here's how you can move from online to offline organizing and guide people through that. And so that's the place where we've experimented the most with technology. And we were very adept at using Zoom and texting thousands of people rapidly to kind of spread the message and help to use the tool that we have when you can't do it face-to-face in the kind of traditional practice of organizing. How do you give people the coaching and guidance to take the next step from wherever they are in mass? And having that practice has, you know, in a lot of ways prepared us for the current moment of most of the work usually is just in person in our communities in growing Sunrise movement. And suddenly even your local unit of community, your local Sunrise hub, is all online. And so we've been a bit, I'd say we've had a bit of an upper edge of feeling prepared for that and having the tools and being ready to go. We've been able to give hundreds of local groups Zoom channels so that they can continue to build local community through online channels. And I think I'll go a little bit just into the present moment too, of there's also, there's a lot we can talk about in the present moment. I'm curious what you're thinking, but obviously it's hard. We talked about this earlier of the devastation of not knowing when I can sing with my movement next and feeling like that can be really hard. And I'm not going to say it's not hard at all, because it's a pretty scary time to think about social movement building under isolation. But at the same time, the balance of that is, I think I really do feel grounded in a massive opportunity to bring a lot of new people into the movement in this time, both through, I think both through a lens of people are getting newly politicized around the failure of the government to address the crisis. And there's kind of a new opening of building out of that awakening. But back to the technology side of just people, we also have this opportunity to facilitate community online in a time of deep isolation, and some people have new time, and I think Sunrise has a big opportunity to be a place that's a home and a place of purpose for young people kind of struggling with this moment. We ran this little experiment a couple weeks ago that was really exciting, where we were kind of, you know, I talked about how we have this training program that's usually in person and we're running that, but we're like, okay, let's try to move the training program online and see what happens. And we called it Sunrise School.
Yes. I taught some of the folks involved in that.
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah. Well, it's been a journey. It was kind of rapidly, you know, suddenly we have this massive operation of teams of facilitators and teams of Zoom tech people running all the different rooms. And it looked like a college schedule every single day. There's like little courses all the time and courses on how to build art in social isolation, courses on how to organize and continue to build your community, and courses on the Green New Deal and what is it. And rapidly built this school structure online, and within a few weeks had 10,000 people sign up and participate in some level of Sunrise School. And we were totally blown away by it. We're kind of like, oh, that's crazy. And it's a little messy. And there's different kinks that need to get worked out in different places about how to run that kind of program at scale. We've never run a 10,000 person school online, and here we are. And so we're taking a bit of we put ourselves on spring break so we can study and improve our systems and come back with a bigger and stronger program. But it revealed to us that, you know, there's potential out there. There's people who want to join and they want community, and we can provide that right now.
No, I think it's really extraordinary moment of both challenge and possibility. I mean, I've never experienced a moment like this where globally, where there's a kind of global shock to everyday life. I mean, and of course, all the inequalities become so visible. All the deeply dysfunctional is a kind word. All the deeply flawed is too weak a word. The features of our system that systematically devalue human life and value wealth over human life. I mean, it's sort of like 40 years of valuing everything by price. Mm-hmm. And so by doing that, we lost the capacity to value health, education, life itself. I mean, it's also visible right now.
Yes.
The question then is, how do we respond to that? How do we deal with that? And the spirit that you're describing to me seems so important, because it is also opening up these new opportunities.
I would go back and forth on this. This feels kind of like an existential question of organizing in this current age of how we all feel about technology and its ability to hinder or help our ability to build power. Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously we use a lot of technology in Sunrise, and I believe in its strengths. And I think that we've had in Sunrise, when we reckon with, you know, where we've succeeded and where we've fallen short of, we think we've kind of done well with the explosive moments, with kind of catalyzing a lot of momentum into a very specific moment and pushing forward together. And we've done well spreading campaigns across the country through online communication. And a lot of the where we are right now is trying to say, hey, how can we deepen our craft and our commitment to some of the age-old practice of community organizing? And how do you say, yes, we can, there's new ways to connect and we can get online, but say, and you still really have to commit to each other and to a team and to a structure and make it last. And there's something that's hard about that. That feels like a trade-off of sometimes you can have lots of people quickly or less people for a long time. And we're kind of trying to do both. And that is the challenge. And we feel like we need to lean more on some of the stable structure-based organizing to really root the movement.
So how do you see climate change returning to the agenda?
There's obviously, this is an explosive moment, and everything that we thought this year would look like is turned on its head, and we're all trying to figure it out. And that is trying to figure it out is where we are right now. But it feels, you know, Sunrise is rooted in the vision of the Green New Deal and the belief that to address the climate crisis, we need mass action marshaled by the federal government at a scale that hasn't been seen since the Great Depression and World War II. And, you know, that is the base of the Green New Deal. And we kind of imagined that the climate crisis would become the crisis that could catalyze that mass action. And here we find ourselves unexpectedly in a very deep, very present crisis. And, you know, we're at a level of unemployment that hasn't been seen since the time of the Great Depression. And I think we're at 33 million now. I don't know the number. It's going up very quickly. And that is, you know, it's not too hard to start drawing the parallels of how we were thinking about the crisis and the response and how we are thinking about it now. And you start to layer the questions on top of each other. So we're thinking, you know, okay, imagine somebody loses their job right now under COVID, and they're doing probably what everyone's doing right now across the country of being on the phone every day with the unemployment office trying to get through, and all the systems are overloaded and it's drawing a huge toll on, you know, on people across the country. And okay, and then imagine in 2 years they're hit by a climate disaster of sorts, if it's a disaster flood that's like unexpected and in the way that's increasing, or new disaster storms, or it's wildfires, and maybe they can't live where they were living anymore. And you start to like layer on those questions of how we're just in a new moment where, you know, this is a crisis now, and we're in a time where we can expect crises to be hitting us over and over again as a new normal. And so we have to ask the question of how do we address that together? I am very far from believing that I have the answers, but feeling like there is starting to be the sense of a direction forward, you know, and some things feel clear that we need to build. Well, it feels clear that this is, you know, the core question, I'd say, as well. Like, it's going to be the core question of the election this year. It's going to be the core question of the next administration, is what will economic recovery look like in 2021 and now and in 2021 moving forward. And that we have an opportunity to put forward a vision of what that looks like. And for us, a lot of that is still rooted in the core pillars of the Green New Deal. And feeling like there's an opportunity to come out of this crisis moving in that direction, and thinking about, you know, okay, we need to be thinking not about just immediate relief, but permanent relief, that an economic recovery plan must also prevent future job loss and put the 30 million people who are unemployed back to work, and ensure that those jobs offer fair wages and protections for time to come. And kind of seeing this as a once in a generation opportunity to like move forward in that direction for all Americans to have good work and good union paying jobs that we all deserve. And then to layer on the climate question of, keeping those multiple crises back in mind, that an economic recovery plan that we move forward with must make us more resilient to the accelerating crises of climate change and environmental degradation, and asking what that looks like. And I think that is, you know, those are the core questions that we're working on and working to put forward the vision that we want to fight for, that can carry us for the next time to come.
The word resilience, I think, is a really important word, because I asked you about your sources of resilience. You know, I heard you describe home and how there was a lot of love in that. Your resilience didn't just come from nowhere. There's something there that felt like a deep value to you, and you seem to draw great strength from it. Mm-hmm. If you look at the situation now, in some ways you could say that people are far more resilient than the systems. People are really taking care of each other.
Oh, yeah. You're speaking to what's happening in our movement too. And I want to go back to, I mean, you keep taking me back to my home, which I appreciate in this conversation. Yeah. And it's, yeah, I appreciate that. And it's bringing up for me a moment that I'm thinking about of, what I learned from growing up in a place that was prone to crises, you know, local crises around being very early on the front lines of climate change. But I think, and you keep talking about hope too, which is also, it's having me think about this of, I think I, at a very early age, began to associate hope and community and crisis together as a kid. I remember one of the worst storms, one of the worst storms that hit, I think I must have been in middle school at the time, maybe a little younger, hit where I grew up, and we, you know, there was trees down everywhere. We didn't have power for 10 days. I was out of school for 2 weeks or more, and different homes in my neighborhood were condemned and people couldn't live in them. And it was just kind of the worst storm that had hit really in my lifetime living there. And it was chaotic. But when I think about myself as a child in that moment, those are some of the happiest moments that I can remember. And it's because I saw my community come together in a way that they hadn't been.
What did you actually see?
Well, I saw, the neighborhood on a normal day was kind of a keeping up with the Joneses, people battling over lawns and cars and stuff. And then in that moment of crisis, it was, we're all cooking food for each other. We're housing each other. Your house is crushed down, so you can come into my house. Most people don't have power, but this person has a generator, so we're all going to go over there and cook dinner. And it was this moment for me that was kind of, it was almost like as a kid, I was like, what? Like you adults knew how to do this the whole time? Like you had the inherent ability to turn towards each other and cooperate and collaborate, and we could be having food together with my friends, you know, all the time. And it was kind of this, why don't we behave this way of caring for each other all the time? And I see that we can do that. And so it really, I do have this sense of, I do believe that we are on the pathway for deeper, more crises that are going to continue to hit our communities for time to come. And it will be hard. And I feel this kind of grounded hopefulness that I've seen how crisis can bring out like a greater awareness of like opening a door for us to connect with our communities and to see things that are bigger than ourselves. And that's playing out in our movement right now. If you're kind of like, are people learning, you know, how's it going in Sunrise? Are people learning how to care for each other? And that is happening, and it's happening totally on its own. You know, there was no kind of mandate from any one person that said, okay, now we're all going to do this. Like people just started to say from all the different hubs, you know, there's about 300 different hubs in Sunrise, and kind of talk to each other across the country. And people started to say, hey, like, here's how we're building neighborhood teams over here. And here's how we're connecting people to meet our needs around groceries and safety. And it just kind of started to happen. And that's happening, you know, we've seen that not just in Sunrise, obviously, but across the country right now. And I do think it's connected, you know, that's what we need right now, because we're in a crisis and people need help and we have to respond directly to our communities. And we're finding out that we have the skills to do that. And it's connected to like the scale of activity that we talk about as the North Star of our movement. Sunrise was kind of launched in this vision that we are building towards a stage of mass non-cooperation. And that is at the scale of millions of people, kind of removing participation from the status quo is the kind of action that we need in order to actually transition society. And, you know, that's what we've seen in studying the organizing that brought about the New Deal and the kind of unprecedented strikes that characterized the whole decade of the 30s. And I remember I was leading a workshop on this of kind of like long-term strategy in Sunrise and mass escalation skills. And I realized you probably have this moment where you have this sudden realization where you're as teacher, as trainer, and you're like, oh, me and the audience are totally on a different page. And I realized that the way that I was talking about escalation skills for the group was translating in like, can you plan an action? Can you do these kind of hard skills? And I had this moment, I was like, oh, I need to be really clear right now. Like when I'm talking about escalation skills and direct action skills, I'm also fundamentally talking about increasing our capacity to care for one another. Because that is what we are going to need to like weather the storm of mass action of millions striking, you know, doing the work that we're going to have to do to transform our country to be able to adapt to the climate crisis and build that mass movement. And it is so rooted in having the skills to care for one another.
The experience you describe of seeing the way people can be with each other in the face of adversity seems like a huge source of hope for you. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be for all of us, because that's where it needs to be. Thank you so much, Diane. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And I wish you the best of luck. And it's more than luck. It's also study, in the sense that you put it, which allows you and your people to move us forward.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And it does feel like a big honor to talk to you. And after being in study and also following in so much of the path of the work that you've done over the years, wow, and being so public and sharing and the experimentation and the learnings and seeing that, I feel one of the many thousands of people, wow, have been able to pick that up and learn and try to see what we can take from it as we build forward. So it does feel like an honor to have this conversation, and I really appreciate it.
Well, your hopefulness, Diana, gives me hopefulness. Thank you so much for sharing this time with me. Thank you for joining us for Faces of Change with Diana J. from Sunrise. If you'd like to learn the tools to organize and lead change in your own community, you can do this through the Leading Change Network. Go to LCN's website to learn more. Coming up in our next episode, we turn our focus to the fight for racial justice in the United States and elsewhere. I'll be joined by Arisha Hatch, the Managing Director of Campaigns at Color of Change. Color of Change is America's largest digital racial justice organization with 1.7 million members. Their mission is to empower Black communities to organize, to improve the lives of those communities by building lasting political power. Until then, keep healthy, keep safe, and join us next time.